Thank you, everyone, for being here today. I think we're at a very exciting time with the whole issue of pre-exposure prophylaxis and a lot of questions, and I couldn't imagine a better group of colleagues to talk about these issues here at APHA, which is definitely the venue where we have to think about the operational implementation issues. So it's really been a very exciting time in HIV prevention in the last 18 months or so. There was the first proof of concept in humans that antiretroviral chemoprophylaxis was effective in decreasing HIV transmission. That was the CAPRISA study, which was conducted in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. Subsequent to that was the IPREX study, and that will be a major focus of my remarks today. But we also have to keep in mind that even more recently, this summer, there was the HBTN-052 study, which showed that starting initiating antiretroviral therapy earlier decreased HIV transmission when treating the infected individual. So if you try to line this up, and Slim and Karesha Abdul-Karim very nicely put this together, and there are some negative trials, and I want to talk a little bit about them as well, but if we take the results from some of the key positive studies, the best result, if you look at the effect size and look at the confidence intervals, was really HBTN-052, 96% reduction. PrEP for discordant couples, heterosexuals, and for MSM, was in this middle range, and the key issue here really relates to adherence, and I'll show you a little data to corroborate that. So really, antiretrovirals, based on randomized controlled trials, very significant level of evidence, really compare quite favorably with some of the other approaches. There was one SED intervention study that decreased transmission, but there were eight others that were negative studies. So I think that we definitely have a cornerstone for the future of HIV prevention, but how do we use it in the most effective ways of the big set of questions that we have to address. So some people have said, well, why even talk about PrEP? Why not just treat everybody as quickly as possible? And I think for this group, probably a lot of these comments are fairly clear, that a lot of people don't disclose because of stigma around the world. There's issues of intimate partner violence. There's some populations where the likelihood of being infected by a primary partner is quite low. People who go to sex clubs, people are engaging in transactional sex for survival. So it's really not a strategy relying on treating everybody and getting the community viral load down in and of itself. There's been some very careful modeling that's been done that says that PrEP plus ART in places where the epidemic is spreading most rapidly can actually be synergistic. So the questions really are, can we dose more efficiently so we use less drug for HIV uninfected people? So that's one big question. What about using different drugs? And there's work going on there I'd like to mention. And then this issue, topical versus oral, I think is another major question now that we have proof of concept, at least in some populations, for these approaches. So the IPREX study enrolled 2,499 men who have sex with men and transgender women in Latin America primarily, also in Boston, San Francisco, Chiang Mai, and Cape Town. And the study overall had this decrease in incidence of 44% in the primary analysis. What's really important were some secondary analyses. So this was an analysis looking at adherence. So the cases that are HIV infected, these are individuals who became infected who were assigned to the tenofovir FTC arm of the study compared to controls who did not become infected. So it's a 3-to-1 match in the case control study. And what you see there, TNF-DP is tenofovir diphosphate. That's an intracellular metabolized moiety of tenofovir active moiety. TFV is tenofovir free in the plasma. Similarly, FTC, the other drug in the combination, has to be triphosphorylated to be active, and then FTC in plasma. And you can see that among individuals who subsequently became HIV infected who were, quote, failures of chemoprophylaxis, when they looked at their blood the visit before they became HIV infected, so that's within a 4-week window, only 10% of the individuals had any drug in their body. Whereas if they looked at the people who did not become infected, they found drug in at least one of the compartments in 44% of the individuals. So if you do the math, the predictive value of having drug in your body was over 90% protection. So it really highlights this issue that adherence is the Achilles heel of this whole approach for PrEP. One of the other concerns that people have had in the IPREX study would be you're recruiting men who are, by self-definition, risky. aren't they going to continue to be risky, particularly if they think they may be getting something protective? Well, again, there's the artifact of a clinical trial, but at least we can say from a safety standpoint that 60% of the men at the time that they started the study, whether they're in the placebo group or the active arm, reported unprotected receptive anal intercourse within the 4 weeks prior to starting the study, and that went down substantially in the first 3 months, but it stayed at a plateau. So I think we can say that the counseling, at least in the context of these trials, does decrease risk-taking behavior. You're not seeing an increase in risk-taking. Now, the reason why some of these demonstration projects that you'll be hearing about are so important is because this is not the real world. I like to say that the informed consent is something only a lawyer could love, you know, because you're telling the participants you may not be getting active medication, and if you're getting active medication, it might not work, and it might have side effects. Now that we have proof of concept that this approach works, we really need to see in a non-randomized way with open label, do people start becoming riskier if they use antiviral prophylaxis. But at least in the beginning, we can say in the context of ethically conducted clinical trials, we're not seeing people becoming riskier. The other issue was adverse events. The bar in terms of people who are HIV uninfected, what is acceptable level of toxicity? So one of the big concerns was effects on kidney function, because in people living with HIV, there are certainly reports of people having renal abnormalities when using tenofovir. Now, again, this is a bias of this kind of study, because to enter the study, you had to have normal renal function. But having said that, there was a non-significant trend towards more renal events, but in terms of any kind of permanent renal problems with the careful monitoring of the trial, there was virtually no one who had any permanent abnormalities. So drug gets stopped, creatinine goes back to normal. One individual, the creatinine would keep bumping when they got re-challenged, so they stayed off the drug permanently. That's one out of more than 1,200 people in the trial. The most common side effects were nausea and inadvertent weight loss. Those were statistically significant. The nausea tended to remit within about 3 to 4 weeks, but this is very important for clinicians and counseling people starting PrEP, that you may feel a little queasy the first few weeks, and you should be aware of that before you commit to this kind of regimen. One other safety signal, though, does bear ongoing monitoring, and this is bone mineral density changes. This is using a DEXA scan looking at bone density. And this was from the IPREC study. Very similar data from the CDC PrEP safety study also were noted. It wasn't consistent across all bone groups. So in the hip, really, if you look over 72 weeks, the changes pretty much merge. You can see the confidence bars overlapping each other. But there was a small, not clinically significant, but statistically significant difference in people who were assigned to tenofovir FDC compared to placebo in the spine area. What does this translate to if you take these pills for the next 30 or 40 years, or what happens if you're perimenopausal, for women who are taking it, or for men who have other risk factors for osteoporosis? The answer is we don't know. But it certainly is an argument, again, for more parsimonious regimens that might mean that the exposure to tenofovir FDC may be less. So this is something that some of the ongoing studies are monitoring over time. The other question people have said is, isn't this going to select for drug resistance? So what we know from IPREX was that among the individuals who became infected actually at the time that they were randomized, so in other words, these were people who were antibody negative at screening visit, antibody negative at enrollment visit, but then 4 weeks into the study, they were antibody positive, and then the lab went back and actually looked at their looked at whether they had plasma viremia, and of 10 individuals who were viremic when they started the study, there were only two who were assigned the tenofovir FTC arm, and they both did acquire resistance to FTC. One person out of 8 in the placebo group who became infected at around the time that they entered the study also became infected with a strain that was resistant to 3TC and FTC. So the take-home here is that if you're viremic, you're at high risk for selecting for resistance, which makes sense because people, when they're in the process of becoming HIV infected, have a high level of plasma viral replication, and that's a setup if you're giving one or two antiretroviral drugs to select for resistance. It's also notable, though, that of more than 100 individuals who became infected after they were already in the study, so they had drug exposure or the placebo, none of them became infected with a resistant strain. So the take-home from this and then some of the similar studies conducted in heterosexual cohorts is that you really need to screen people very carefully for whether they're in the process of becoming HIV infected before they start PrEP. But if they once they start PrEP, if they are consistent PrEP users, the likelihood that they're going to select for resistance is extremely low. We can't say it can't happen because it's only a limited number of observations so far. But it's not an easy thing to select for. But obviously the caveats are knowing whether the person's viremic before they start medication and also making sure that they're adherent. Because if you don't take the drug, then you become infected with HIV. Then you start taking the pills again. You could certainly select for resistance in that kind of setting. So one other headline that I think is very important to discuss in this context, even though the nature of this symposium is focusing on men who have sex with men, but there were two studies of PrEP in the past year that were terminated because of futility. One was the FemPrEP study, which looked at tenofovir FTC versus placebo, and then the VOICE study is a very ambitious study. This is a study looking at different options for women. It enrolled 5,000 women in sub-Saharan Africa. The women were assigned either to a gel or a pill. The gel would be tenofovir gel or placebo gel, and the pill would be tenofovir alone, tenofovir plus FTC, or a placebo pill. And the FemPrEP study terminated in April, and the Microbicide Trials Network that was conducting the VOICE study ended the tenofovir only arm, the oral tenofovir only arm, just last month. And basically, these were randomized controlled trials of at-risk African women. Some of the women had multiple exposures in the course of a day, engaging in transsexual sex, commercial sex work. The women were, in these studies, generally asked to use hormonal contraception, and yet they had a very high pregnancy rate in these studies, 9% in the FemPrEP study. So we still don't know the answer. Why did this approach not work for women when the Partners PrEP study did work for women and when other PrEP studies have been successful? And the answer may be non-adherence. Hormonal contraception may make you nauseated. If tenofovir makes you nauseated when you first use it, there may be differential non-adherence in the active medication arm. The other part of the puzzle, though, may be pharmacology. So this is work done by Craig Hendricks in the Microbicide Trials Network. And what it basically is looking at is vaginal and tissue concentrations of tenofovir when women were exposed to it either orally or topically. And basically the take-home really is this circle here. If you compare the tissue tenofovir levels and you look at the red and the blue, which are vaginal or dual approaches, and you compare that to the green lower down, that is like a two-log difference. So basically, you have a much lower percentage of drug getting into vaginal tissues. It turns out that tenofovir gets very well absorbed into rectal tissues when given systemically. So oral PrEP may work quite well for people exposed rectally, but it may not work so well for women who may be exposed vaginally. Again, this is still a work in progress, but this is one reason why we cannot assume because these drugs work for one population, it's going to necessarily work for another, or because it works for one route of exposure, that it'll work for another route of exposure. So the future of PrEP, one issue is can we give less drug? So if you imagine a line going across the top at 100%, if you gave the drug every day, actually if you give the drug 22 hours before, and as long as you give a dose 2 hours after, or 3 days before and then 2 hours after, and it's pretty good even if it's 7 days before and 2 hours after, you get quite high rates of protection in the animal model. And it's not as good if you give it just 2 hours before and then 22 hours later. So this dosing right before you go out to the club and then forgetting till the next day may not be as good. So the question is, can we actually translate this to human trials? And there has been some work going on in this area of intermittent PrEP. The International AIDS Vaccine Initiative has had a study in East Africa focusing on men who have sex with men and female sex workers. It's a very small number, but they did document that a number of the individuals missed the post-coital dose. So if you're not going to go back home and you don't take the pill with you before you go out to the club and you don't take that rapid post-coital dose, that can be problematic. So there are two other studies that are looking at this question in the HIV Prevention Trials Network. One is a pharmacology study, really with directly observed regimens to say, if you give up the dosing twice a week, how much of the time do you have high therapeutic levels in the different compartments in the body? So that study is underway. The other study that's just enrolling now is looking at men who have sex with men in Bangkok and high-risk women in Cape Town. And that study is looking at comparing which is preferable. Do you dose it on Friday and do you dose it on Monday if you're going to have most of your risk behavior over the weekend? Or is it better to do this periquital dosing because you can't necessarily predict when you're going to have sex? So again, a lot of this relates to behavior. A lot of this relates to pharmacology. There are two European PrEP studies in men who have sex with men that have not started but are getting underway soon. They're both looking at periquital dosing as well, one conducted by the French. And they did some preliminary work and said that about 40% of a group of at-risk French men who have sex with men who were recruited online were interested in PrEP and thought this idea of not having to take it every day was something very desirable. And a similar study getting underway in the UK. What about rectal gel? So we're talking about pills. And we're saying that gel may be good for women because of the pharmacology. What about rectal gel? Well, in the animal model, rectal gel is quite protective for monkeys after rectal challenge. There was a study that actually looked at the vaginal formulation of tenofovir applied rectally, and this was conducted in L.A. and Pittsburgh. And the men and women in that study did not tolerate the vaginal gel. And that's because the vaginal gel contains glycerol, which stimulates peristalsis. So, you know, if you're applying something and you're anticipating sex and you feel an urge to go to the bathroom, that's not a very desirable property. So it's back to the drawing board, and there's a reformulated product that has been well tolerated. It's been studied now in Pittsburgh, Boston, Birmingham, and hopefully either at the retrovirus conference or upcoming microbicide conference, those data can be presented in public. And there's a study of young men who have sex with men also looking at this new rectal gel formulation. And there's a expanded safety and preliminary efficacy trial that's planned for next year to start looking at this in both the U.S. and several international settings. There are other agents also being looked at. And the one I put in red, Maraviroc, many of you who are clinicians know that this is a drug that's already FDA approved. And there are studies that are getting underway in the HIV Prevention Trials Network over the next year to look at Maraviroc orally as a potential PrEP candidate. And part of the rationale here is that you'd rather not use the same drugs for prevention as you use for treatment, so you avoid selection for cross-resistance. So there are other agents coming down the pike, both topically and orally. So where are we? Well, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has issued an interim guidance focusing on men who have sex with men based on the IPREX data. And Dr. Baldessari may want to talk more about sort of the current thinking of where the next level of guidance may be going based on the more recent studies. But we do have some messaging out there. This was an advertisement by Gay Men's Health Crisis for Community Forum that occurred in June in New York City. And so the question is some of this subtle messaging leading to an uptake in PrEP use either covert or in clinical settings? We did a study presented at the International AIDS Society meeting in Rome with Manhunt, which is a social networking site based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with the national reach. And we did a quick survey right before IPREX, and then we did a larger survey post-IPREX for about a month. Got a large response rate. And you can see still, even post-IPREX, only about a fifth of the men who are in Manhunt, where you'd think that people might be more knowledgeable about this. This was in April and May this past year. Only about a fifth of men had heard of PrEP, and we actually wanted to look at whether people actually had taken PrEP. Less than 1% had used PrEP, and less than 2% had used PEP, which is really concerning given that there's been public health service guidance for this for a number of years. So the last couple points, you know, many people say this is going to break the bank. This is just too expensive. There are different models, and it's the old Mark Twain, lies, damn lies, and statistics. It's what inputs you want to put into the model. But this one paper by Desai, I think, is very interesting because this quality-adjusted life year metric says if something is less than $50,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, it's quite cost-effective. It could even potentially be cost-saving. But the thing that really throws this off is this whole issue of risk compensation, so that if people actually increase their risk-taking behavior, it throws the model out the window. Matt Golden, the King County, Washington Department of Health, estimated like how many at-risk men in Seattle and how many at-risk men in the U.S. might benefit from PrEP. And per his calculations, again, you know, very back of the envelope, you know, that PrEP could really consume a substantial amount, even more than current amounts spent on prevention. So obviously, focusing on who would most benefit from PrEP is going to be a really key issue for public health going forward. The other issue we just can't forget is that PrEP can't be considered as the magic bullet. We have to deal with the other issues that make people either non-adherent to medication or HIV infected or not likely to engage in care if HIV uninfected. So to my mind, this is the future mantra. If we're thinking about prevention, it's combination antiretroviral prevention. At the beginning, you have to think about how to increase testing. And then if you test, we really need better tests so we can pick up acute infection. If you're really testing somebody who's risky, they may have a substantial risk of being in a window period and you don't want them to start PrEP at that point. If you can accurately assess who's positive and negative, there clearly is a subset of people who benefit from PrEP. But among people who are positive, there's a whole cascade that says that we're not doing such a great job of getting these individuals in care, enrolled in care, stably adherent to heart, and maintaining virologic suppression. And clearly, if you don't address all the underlying concomitant issues such as depression, substance use, relationship dynamics, we may not get it very far. And we may have to think about creative ideas like incentivizing adherence for some of these interventions. If we get all that right, then we can decrease HIV transmission. I just want to thank you very much. I want to thank some of my colleagues at Fenway and colleagues who are doing similar work who lent me slides and have helped my thinking on this. Thank you so much.